This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
When you plan a renovation, you have a list of must-haves. Maybe it's an ensuite, or it could be a butler's pantry or a patio out the back. Well, Melbourne Airport is having a $4.5 billion renovation. So what are your must-haves? It was announced today that the renovation would include things like 5 new gates for jumbo jets, new retail and lounge facilities, as well as better baggage and waiting areas for when you meet someone at the airport. So what's number one on your list of improvements for the airport? What currently makes you dread air travel? And what is the most important thing you think needs to be included in this huge airport renovation? Our number's 1-300-222-774. And also coming up this hour, 25 years today since Don Bradman died. He would have been 92. So how is it all these years later, with all of the technology, all of the coaching and all of the money, we still haven't produced another Don Bradman?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
If you do a renovation, a big renovation, you have a list, right? Things that you desperately want, that you dream of, things that would make your life easier. So if you do a big renovation at Melbourne Airport, a $4.5 billion makeover, what are your lists of must-haves? When we think about airline travel, what currently makes it stressful? When you travel around the world, what makes airports really tick? What makes them great? So what's at the top of your list? 1-300-222-774. This, I love this already. Rochelle, the must list for airports to increase the number of cubicles in the female toilets. The lines are horrendous at all times. That's from Kylie in Upper Ferntree Gully. Kylie, that's gone on the top of my list as well. If you are building and renovating and spending $4.5 billion on the airport, and we still have to line up to go to the loo because you haven't put enough toilets in, that's a big fail. Robert's in Sunbury. Hi, Robert.
There's no bicycle access out of the airport. I've talked to the airport people many times.
Yep.
It's very close to the Mooney Ponds bike path, but you can't get easy access. It's terrible.
So that's on the top of your list. That makes sense, Robert, doesn't it?
Well, if anyone's coming for a bicycle tour of Australia, it's I don't even know if you can get your bike on to the Skybus. There's no train.
So when you mentioned it to them, what was the response?
Oh, they nodded their head and said, oh, yes, yes.
I wonder if you can put your bikes on the Sky Bus, you know, like a commuter bus where sometimes you can hook. I know on Phillip Island, the cows bus is a small comparison, Robert. But if you ride your bike to cows and then you don't want to ride your bike back, you can put your bike on the bus. So I wonder whether or not you can put your bike on the Sky Bus. If someone's done it, you can let us know. Lots of this saying, airport, it needs a railway station. This one, for the love of God, just build the train. Danny's in Glen Iris. What's on the top of your renovation list for Melbourne Airport?
Oh, I just reckon a good quality coffee outlet. I guess it's not so much renovation as improving the availability. If Melbourne's supposed to be a foodie and coffee capital, then show it at the airport and also make our flights better.
So just better quality food.
Yeah, in particular coffee, actually.
Yeah, right. You need it a lot. It's important.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think part of, we spend a lot of time there, don't we? Absolutely, we spend a lot of time there. So being able to get good coffee, good food is something that's important to you. Henry's in Broadford.
At top of the list, more efficient passenger drop-off and pick-up system.
That is actually on their list, which is interesting, Henry. And I just wonder how that would actually work. We might try and find out in just a moment. This, an observation deck. It would be wonderful to experience this. It was always wonderful as a child. That's come through from Linda. Well, David Holm is a principal at Cox Architecture, specialising in transport and urban design, also the author of Drawing the City. And I know, David, you've designed many airports, including Newcastle and some of the terminals at Changi in Singapore. When you look through the list of what Melbourne Airport is considering, from jumbo, extending some of the areas for jumbo jets, looking at drop-offs and pickups, are these all vital areas of this renovation?
Good morning, Rochelle. How are you? It's important, I think, to consider that an airport such as Melbourne, and Melbourne's, you know, a key city in Australia and, you know, as a world network, they really need to connect into their broader city and the facilities that they provide. I heard one of your listeners there suggesting about train stations. You know, if you look worldwide, that's a must. That's a sort of start to play the game sort of situation. The other thing that's really important is the facilities that are at airports really have to be the best. They have to be commensurate with what exists in a city. And if a city is a foodie city, for example, then, you know, an airport is a place that just has to identify with that as part of the community. So I think for many years, airports are often seen as sort of remote processing centres that you had to go to on occasion and it was difficult, whereas now they really have to be, you know, great and integrated parts of the community and the best of civic architecture in many respects.
I love that, remote processing centres. And they would feel so foreign, like they weren't a part of our world, that we'd stepped into this alternate universe. And some of the ideas, David, that are coming through are really basic things. Things like this, a must, is to separate the pedestrian traffic from the car park and the drop-off car traffic. That's from James. And another that says the baggage claim and the exit area from the international airport is just embarrassing. It's a conga line to the back of the gates. Another one, there's so many ideas, David. I'd like to see painted lines on the floor like they do in some hospitals, directing you to various areas of the airport. There's just not enough signage and it's up too high to see properly. Do we overlook the basics sometime, David?
Well, I think what we're seeing happening at the moment, and many airports in Melbourne will be doing this as well, is that the technological advances that are happening with processing are moving so quickly. So the adoption of those will make travel much easier. So a lot of the stories that we sort of often have experienced or have heard, I think will become less because there's much more sophisticated systems about wayfinding, about getting your bags, etc. You know, early check-in. Around the world, there's lots of things that are happening that are incorporating new ideas into travel. So the experience will be a better one as technology is incorporated. And I think what that does, it allows people to actually spend quality time in a lot of these environments. Now, whether that means you're traveling with a group or indeed just by yourself, it's that essence of creating a place that you actually want to go and spend some time at, not that it's just a process. It has to be beyond that it's a place that you actually think, well, I'm traveling, so I might go and spend an extra hour there because .. is really good.
Yeah, exactly, and make it an enjoyable experience. I want to pick your brains on this text in just a moment because Michael, who's from Geelong, sent a message saying, just replicate Changi Airport. And I know, David, that you actually did design some of the terminals there. But while we have you, I want to have a chat to Therese, who's in Torquay. Good morning.
Yes, hello. My wish would be for, as I live with a disability, would be to have greater disability access. I do have disability assistance when I fly, but often you're pushed in a wheelchair and you're in a corner or you're in an area waiting for up to an hour, separated from my husband who's in another area and we don't know what's happening. It's almost like you have to wait and wait forever until maybe someone's free to come and take you. And it's really hard to be able to then get something to eat and drink, or you just sort of put somewhere and you have to fend for yourself.
That's terrible, Therese. Gosh, I've had a lot of texts like this. Another one saying better wheelchair access, even on the plane, especially access to the toilets. It's just dreadful. And I can't count the number of exclamation marks that are added to that. Therese, does it put you off flying, air travel altogether?
No, but what I do now is phone. At Melbourne Airport, there's a wonderful service that I used for many years at Southern Cross Station. And for disability support through the station, and only late last year that was opened up at Tullamarine, and the staff that work for that service are amazing.
Yeah, and you don't want to just rely on staff to get you through as well. You would like to see that designed in, Therese, wouldn't you? Thank you. We have a full board of calls, so I'm going to try and work my way through them as quickly as I can. David Holm is with you, principal at Cox Architecture, who specialises in transport and urban design and has been behind many of the airports that you may have travelled through. David, does disability, how high up on the list of priorities of the Melbourne Airport renovation do you think disability is?
Oh, it would be at the highest level. There's no doubt about that. I mean, one of the things about, you know, contemporary travel, whether we're talking about an airport or a railway station or, you know, I'm in Sydney, so ferries and things like that, is that it has to be available to everybody in an egalitarian sense. So that really is a number one priority, access all areas. And, you know, with that comes situations such as safety and, you know, one of your earlier callers mentioned things like amenities as well too. So, you know, there's sort of gender provisions there, family rooms, et cetera. So that idea
of... Yeah,
the
family rooms. I've had text saying a play space really for kids. You know,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So all those things are really important. And in many respects, that's just a ticket to play to get those things right, to make them that they're actually enjoyable experiences as you go through them. They shouldn't be a hurdle or a barrier. It should be integrated into the design and can be.
So what makes the Changi Airport, of which you were one of the designers behind a couple of the terminals there, what makes it so special? Here's another one, and it says, Rochelle, our Changi Airport is gold standard. The thing I love most is the use of carpet throughout. This creates low noise, low stress, comfortable space. It's brilliant. That's from Anthony. What makes this particular airport so special, David?
Well, I think in that particular case, it was an amazing client. But what they did was to really understand their customer clientele. So it's got a heavy transit passenger, whereas places like, say, Melbourne and Sydney are more origin destinations. So Changi is all about transit. So you've got to keep people interested and you know, engaged for, you know, maybe 2 hours, maybe 10 hours, for example. So nothing was off the table, and we had, you know, ideas. There's a cactus garden that's there. There's a butterfly enclosure, etc. So there's swimming pools. There's all sorts of things that are in place.
A swimming pool?
Absolutely. And so one of the things about that client was that they put absolutely, you know, first, second and third was the customer and the customer's needs. And then design was seen to follow and support that. And so they've been sort of the torchlight, if you like, for 25 years in providing facilities that put the customer absolutely at the centre of all of the discussions.
How do you think Melburnians would react if we put a pool at Melbourne Airport? I'd be happy, right? I love a swimming pool. But what are the chances of that ever happening, do you think? Do you think we'd be happy? I don't think we would be.
Well, it's maybe it's a pool, maybe it's other sort of community facilities. So if you think about an airport now, it's not just about people who travel. It could be that in the precinct, and you know, we're doing a lot of master plan work around airports at the moment, so in the precinct of the airport itself, there are community facilities, and what that does is start to bring people to the airport environment, and it becomes, again, a more shared community node, that it may be that there is a swimming pool there that's used by the local community, but it also is available for, you know, people using the airport. So it's taking away, if you like, the mono use of airports around the world to be much more multivalent, multi-use, so that people can come to an airport precinct for much wider reasons than they may have done in the past.
The amount of time that we have to spend at airports because, and we do need to tick all of the boxes, safety is a big part of it. We understand that. However, there is text after text, David, coming through, just wanting things to be streamlined a little more. So, and I do know that Melbourne Airport has included in a part of their $4.5 billion upgrade things like the customer and immigration experience. I know they're working very closely with the Australian Border Force to try and make that passenger experience a little better and a little more fit for purpose. How could that be achieved?
Yeah, again, there's lots of programs that are being put in place by airports around the world at the moment to streamline and indeed use technology. And I think you'll see that certainly coming through in Melbourne as well too, is that we're just finishing the Western Sydney Airport at the moment, and that's state-of-the-art facilities. It'll be opening later this year. And what that will see is, you know, the smoothest and most efficient ways that people can move through those often stressful situations. And whilst, you know, border control is probably one of the most important things for an airport to do in many respects and safety, they can be done in a way that is, you know, I guess, amenable to a great travel experience as well, both outgoing and incoming.
Will there be enough toilets? I know that sounds trite, but seriously, whenever you look at big renovations, even if it's of a theatre, and at the end there's a queue of women snaking around the corner, and I'm like, you had your opportunity. There was a time where you could have put in enough cubicles. Do things like that, why do they continually get overlooked, David?
Yeah, it's interesting. We put that really high in our designs as well too, and a lot of the aspects is trying to understand the different kinds of people that are travelling. So you might have families, you might have, you know, parents, et cetera, that are in sort of different environments. So getting the design of the amenities, and it's not just then about toilets, like we said, it's about change rooms, quiet rooms, et cetera. Getting those right is really important because it can really make or break the travel experience that people have. And all too often they've been seen as perfunctory items as opposed to something that actually is a quality part of the experience. It's as important as a great cafe, absolutely. You know, getting all of that stuff right really changes your experience to become a positive one.
Well, wait and see. David, thank you. You weren't asked to participate. You haven't sort of had the feelers reached out to you yet for Melbourne Airport?
It's a work in progress.
Okay. All right. I'll take that as a maybe. Thanks, David. David Holm, Principal at Cox Architecture, specialising in transport and urban design, has been behind many airports, currently working on Western Sydney. You'd know his work from Newcastle as well as Changi, a couple of terminals there, and lots of you referring to that as the gold standard. Some great ideas coming in on what you'd like to see in the $4.5 billion renovation at Melbourne Airport. Sensory room areas for those with sensory issues, maybe sensory walls to encourage children to keep walking, a nursing room for infants, more family toilets, visual aids for children to get up and around, and an aquarium for watching and relaxing whilst waiting. Yeah, I don't mind the idea of an aquarium. I'm popping that on my list. I'm not sure how high up it would be. Michelle Huntington is a former airline captain. And Michelle, whenever I do travel, I don't fly a lot, but whenever I do, and I see the staff and the crew and the pilots cruise through with their little clicky bags and their very fancy uniforms, I always wonder why they don't have a separate section that they can go through. But what would you like to see in this airport rebuild, the $4.5 billion makeover of Melbourne Airport?
Hi, Rochelle. I was in Melbourne just last week and actually had an airside tour of what's going to happen. And there's that, as you go through security in Terminal 3, there's that layout little plan that the public can look at. And, a dedicated lane would be perfect to go through security, customs, although pretty much the crew, if they're in uniform and they have their ID, they can go past.
Jump the line.
Yeah, which I can understand passengers get frustrated about if they've been lining up for ages. I think just the, you know, other airports have just that ability of the streamline, even if it's not actually streamlined, just the perception that it's going fast, that you're special. And even like Sydney Airport now, with all their works going on, there's Virgin have, you know, the dedicated line for premium Velocity members, and there are other programs similar with Qantas, etc., around the network. But
what about more staff, Michelle? I mean, so much is automated now. You can print out your own tags, you can check your own bags, you can do a lot of it before you even arrive. That sort of raises stress levels for me, because I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm probably going to stuff this up. The moment I have somebody helping me in an official capacity, I chill out a little bit and I think, okay, someone who knows what they're doing is helping me here. Since life has become automated, has it made it easier or has it made it more stressful?
Oh, definitely stressful. On Monday, I came back from Melbourne to Sydney, and I don't know about you, but do you take those little barcodes off your bag every single time, the little stickers?
No.
Because I don't. And of course, then the self drop, bag drop doesn't work because it's picking up all of these other codes.
It makes you look like you're well travelled, right, if you leave them on there.
Well, yeah, but it takes a while to then drop your bag because
it's true.
Got lines through it. And I was speaking to a former colleague on Monday, and he was telling me he's part of the, I think it's Fly Before You Buy or Try Before You Fly program that Virgin do. And they actually meet you at the front of the terminal when you get dropped off in the car or the cab, and they take you through every single component of getting on the plane and then meet you the other end, so that those people that are stressed, they've run through it having their hand held, so their expectation, you know, they're not shocked by anything that happens, which I thought was a great idea.
Yeah, if you see a look of fear in someone's eyes and they're kind of having a little bit of a Barney with their partner about who's got, you know, what and what documentation and where you need to be, then you need someone to go over and help them and keep everyone Absolutely. Calm. Michelle, thank you. Toilets is coming through at a rate I can't keep up with. Are you happy with the inside information that you have about Melbourne Airport? Have you got any word on how many women's toilets there's going to be?
I actually don't, but that's a very important point because, if, you know, all these new builds, why they don't, if they actually timed how long it takes for someone, a lady, a woman, to go to the bathroom, just simple bathroom without having children and bags and all the rest, I think they'd probably work out that we would then need 2.5 times that of our male counterparts who, you know, it's a little faster.
Absolutely. Michelle, thank you. It's going to be interesting to see what comes up. Michelle Huntington, former airline captain. Some great ideas coming in. Di says, Rochelle, with Melbourne Airport revamp, I would like to see higher seating in waiting terminals. The present seating is too low and too difficult to rise out of them. Di, that's good. I like this one too from John in Mornington. Sleeping pods. Like they have in Japan. That's good too. Airports use enormous amounts of water, and says this text, what about rain collection? That should be high on their priority list as well. Keep those ideas, those thoughts coming through. I'll try and get back to them a little later in the program. But coming up next, ABC's very own Paul Kennedy and I will look at why is it all these years later we still haven't produced another Don Bradman.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
He hit 'em high, he hit 'em straight. He's more than just a batsman, but something like a tide. More than just one man, he could take on any side. They always came for Bradman, his fortune used to hide in the palm of his hands.
So 25 years today since Don Bradman died. So how is it? All this time later, all the technology, all the coaching, all the money that we have that we throw towards sport and individuals, how is it that we still haven't produced another Don Bradman? Paul Kennedy, of course, ABC sports journalist, creator of the ABC documentary, the award-winning, dare I say, documentary, Mr. Paul Kennedy, of Bradman and Tanduka. What is it? I mean, could we produce
no.
another Don Bradman? No.
No, we can't.
Why?
We can't. I don't know if I can answer that question. He was a freak. He was just a freak of sport. And if you look across statistically, as people have done, have measured him against other people in sport, you know, the second best, if they look at statistics and goals per game and all that sort of stuff across different sports, you know, they come up with Wayne Gretzky as an ice hockey player, and they look at other cricket players, they just don't come close to Bradman in his average, which was almost 100. So he was just a phenomenal player in different respects. He, as our documentary sort of bore out with people comparing his life to Tendulkar, not the two of them compared, but how they existed in their own time and you know, how they were culturally as well. He was this guy who taught himself to bat when he arrived in Sydney out of the bush, out of barrel. He they tried to correct his technique, and then they realised it's not a good idea because he had his own technique. He had this back and across style. And, you know, he never got sick of batting. And he had what we found when we really investigated Bradman's mindset and his approach to the game, he had the perfect performance mindset. He rarely got nervous. He, you know, he didn't. His comment that I found in the archives way back was, other batsmen think about problems that aren't there, and I just hit the ball. He just watched the ball. He was able to focus on the ball without any distraction for long periods of time. His stroke technique, you know, his pull shot was amazing, and he could hit the ball hard and along the ground. So he was just like a, you know, dare I say, it's like a somewhat, if you had to come up with another Bradman, AI would have to do it, and it'd take it.
So isn't that interesting, though, PK, because now we sort of probably, we do have the AI that could do this. Mm-hmm. However, if you look at the simplicity, I mean, one theory that I was reading about today is that we overcoach. We actually try and strip out the individuality in sport now. We overthink it. And when you just said then that he would simplify it, he wouldn't think about problems that aren't there, I just hit the ball. Is it too complicated now? Do we try and strip out someone that maybe has got a quirky style?
Yeah. No, well, look at the next best batsman. It's Steve Smith. No coach in their right mind will take a 10-year-old batter, as we call them now, boy or girl. No one would say, okay, you need to bat like Steve Smith, because it's so unconventional. And the other thing is, he changes the way that he bats. Steve Smith, he'll alter it for different circumstances. So did Tendulkar. Tendulkar's, you know, owns the test runs average, 10 runs record. So he's, you know, on that super plane as well. And he changed the way he batted at different times. He was largely sort of self-taught as well. There's definitely something in the fact that you can't overcoach young players. You need to be able to, but that's well known as well. You know, there are so many good coaches out there who understand that, and they
strip coach that back. But is it even possible to compare cricket of Bradman's era to today? I mean, here's one of the texts: Bradman wouldn't be able to face today's pace bowlers. He was good, ridiculous, because the bowling was average. When you look at cricket of Bradman's era to today, is it actually, do we need to get over this whole thing of creating another Bradman?
The comparison's good, okay? So it might be a question you can't answer. You know, they do that in America all the time. Who was better, you know, across baseball eras and basketball? We should do more of it in Australia. It's good fun. The answer is no, you can't really compare eras all that much, but all that well. But for someone to actually send a text in and say that Bradman couldn't face today's bowling, that is ridiculous. He was so far above everyone else. Talent, reaction time, intellect, as I said, the ability to stay calm under pressure. The bowling was world-class back then. It's world-class now. World-class might be different. But that's ridiculous to say Bradman couldn't compete today. Bradman would be the best in the world today. He was a freak, and that's why we haven't seen, you know, that's why we haven't seen anyone else like him, because he was just amazing outlier. And there are reasons for it, like to examine the way he grew up in a very musical household. He grew up with supportive parents. That's one thing you need to succeed in support in sport. You need that amazing support. He had that. He had parents who didn't put too much pressure on him.
And the dedication to practice. I was talking to my husband today, and I said, and maybe it's because he's, you know, also the coach of a young basketball team who he thinks don't practice enough. But I said, what made him special? And he said, just the dedication that he put on himself, that he was just out there. He was just hitting that golf ball, not even cricket ball, 24/7.
That's right. The modern psychologist would say, would give you a lecture in intrinsic versus extrinsic pressure and motivation. And you can watch kids now, and you can give them a couple of sports to play, and then you sit back and watch. So what do they go out in the backyard and do by themselves? You can put a basketball hoop up in your backyard, but if your child doesn't go out there and play the basketball, they're not that interested. But some kids will go out there and they'll find a couple of balls or rocks or whatever, and they'll
make it work.
They'll throw something against the ball and they'll invent
find a way. That's it. There's a text here that says, "Let's see a current batter with a wicket, a golf ball, and a corrugated iron water tank." Hey, PK, stay with us. Paul Kennedy is with you, ABC sports journalist, of course, the creator of the ABC award-winning documentary Bradman and Tanduka. Because I want to bring Rena Hoare into this conversation, the former executive director of the Bradman Museum. Rena is also a former cricketer herself, currently working at the SCG. Rena, I know you have spoken passionately about cricket should be for everyone. And that's a lot of what Bradman's story is that you can bang a golf ball against a corrugated iron water tank and become the world's best that we still talk about. What was it that made him so special in your eyes? And when people wandered through the Bradman Museum, what were they drawn to?
He was an all-round cricketer. He had an all-round cricket brain in that, yes, he worked out when he was young how to practice, how to improve, what parts of his game. I mean, he used to go out in the backyard and throw the golf ball against an old timber fence to improve his reflexes. He was a fielder. He didn't bowl a lot, though he did bowl, but as a batsman and a fielder, but he was had a great strategy and thinking. So I just think they were drawn to his whole life story. He then went on, as we know, to do 50 years consecutive administration in cricket. He was in every part of cricket. He was an author. You know, that's what they get when they would go around the Bradman Museum. It tells his entire story, from his family life to his time in Bowral to at Sydney to Adelaide, but all of the things that he did for cricket in many different fields. So I think that's probably, he was just an outstanding individual in all of the aspects of his career. So that's what they were really most surprised about, is to see just how much his contribution was overall. But I do agree. There won't be another one of him because he was so far his statistics. He used to say himself, he was quoted many times saying that, you know, champion players adapt to the era in which they play and the surroundings that they come across. So I believe that he would excel in today's era. As some, you know, somebody like Virat Kohli or Steve Smith would probably have excelled in Bradman's era as well.
What about the idea, Rena, of how accessible cricket is or isn't now versus Bradman's era? If there was another, right, waiting in the wings, in the backyard, smashing a rock with a bat against a fence or whatever it may be, is cricket as accessible as it once was?
Oh, I think it's more accessible now than it ever has been.
That's good.
To all genders. So, and in all countries, really. I mean, the development that's going on around the world in cricket makes it very accessible. So I actually believe today that there's so much coverage of cricket, you know, even in junior cricket, there's so much opportunities, there's so many programs and ways of supporting that, you know, it's far more accessible. Back in his era, you know, it was there were less sports to compete with it. So, you know, choices were less. So, therefore, you know, young boys and a few girls were channeled into cricket. But today, even with all of the choices of the other sports that compete with the cricket, I think still very accessible.
Rena, who got you into cricket? Who was your inspiration? Who introduced you to cricket?
What was my father? My father was a Bradman devotee, actually. So I learnt about the history of Sir Donald Bradman through my father, and I was always intrigued in how this one person could monopolise my father's conversation. So, and then, you know, he wanted, when we were country people, so to come to the city to watch cricket at the SCG was a pilgrimage. And Dad used to say, he'd look around, my brother was a golfer, and he'd look at me and he'd say, oh, do you want to come to the SCG? So off we'd go. And, you know, I fell in love. I actually fell in love with the World Series era. So, but I always knew of Sir Donald Bradman through the readings of my dad. He was one of the first people to buy the Bradman albums, and he had everything that was ever written about him in newspaper clippings. And so, yeah, I was introduced to that. And then because, again, country girl, I was sent to boarding school, and I selected my boarding school on the fact that Skeggs Wollongong at the time played cricket.
You must pinch yourself now, Rena, that you work at the SCG.
Yes. Yes. It's interesting how, you know, things go around.
Full circle.
Full circle. Absolutely full circle. Yeah, I do think of those first days of, you know, I was here when the lights came on in World Series cricket. I was here when Ian Chappell was captaining Australia, and I think it was Michael Holding was given a caught behind, was given not out, and I think he tried as he walked back to his bowling mark. Those are the things that I remember as a young girl sitting up on the hill at the SCG. And yes, it's not lost on me that when I walk around here today, no, I think back to those days.
Rena, really lovely to get your thoughts not only on Sir Donald Bradman but on your dad as well. Rena Hoare, thank you. Executive Director of the Bradman Museum, also a former cricketer herself currently at the SCG. Paul Kennedy is with you, ABC sports journalist, creator of the award-winning ABC documentary Bradman and Tanduka. There's something really similar, almost PK, about Rena's story, you know, sort of being from the country, the simplicity of loving cricket and the simplicity of what cricket is, and overthinking it compared to, say, other sports and what we do. Is it kept pure to a certain degree?
Just as I was thinking about that, Rochelle, we've talked about this many times, and it's about junior, you had to get kids into sport and all the rest of it. The thing about Bradman, of course, a different era, no pathways and, you know, all the things you have now, where basically if you're a talented young sports person, 12, 13, someone's going to chuck you in an academy and get you going, and you start training within an inch of your life. Well, Bradman played tennis through adolescence and even had a year off due to injury before he really started taking cricket seriously. And then he was sort of 18 when he came to Sydney and started taking it seriously, and so that probably fed into his love of cricket through his 20s, and he never got burnt out. He didn't seem to, although there were times where he had some injury and, you know, travelling didn't suit him, he played till he was 40. And Rayleigh Thompson is a famous former Australian cricketer who played through the 1980s and played some amazing series for the Australian women's team. And she had a theory too that you probably can play seriously for about 20 years if you're lucky. And so, you know, if you look at kids now who take it seriously when they're 12, 13, well, their burnout chance is quite high. Whereas back in the day, Bradman's circumstances were that he didn't do that. You know, they didn't make him train, or he wanted to train by himself. But yeah, so there's something to be taken from the
older. There's so much to be taken. Get out there and practice. That's what I say. Yeah, you too can be like Bradman.
Practice and relax. And don't, you know, you can enjoy it and just
not overthink it.
You don't have to play, you know, there are kids today who are playing 40, 45 games of cricket over summer because they get into four or five teams. And we've done stories on that before, you know, that there's so many opportunities to play every day of the week almost now. Talk about accessibility, but sometimes good not to play that much, you know, and just to enjoy the season and then play another sport in another season and
played.
Yeah, I love that idea, PK. And like as Bradman said, you know, don't get out there and overthink it. I just hit the ball. PK, thank you. I've learned so much today and there's a lot of love and respect coming through. Don't forget, you can jump onto iView to see that doco of PK's. It's called Bradman and Tendulkar. Good to chat, PK. Thank you.
Thanks, Rochelle. Cheers.
See you, mate. This is my favourite Bradman quote, says this text, was when he was asked later in life what he thought his batting average would be if he played currently. He said, about 75. And when the interviewer said, only 75, Bradman replied, well, you have to remember, I am 80 years old now. You can keep those reflections coming through. 25 years today it's been since Sir Donald Bradman died. Coming up in just a moment, genetic testing and what role it can play in your life and how easily you can access it.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
We'll get back to more of your calls in just a moment on airport design. $4.5 billion renovation happening at Melbourne Airport. What would you like to see? What is on your must list? Mary says, and this is really good, it says, when renovating the airport, can the toilet door please open outwards so you can get your carry-on wheelie bag in with you? I've seen this done overseas in many airport toilets. Mary, thank you. I think we need a whole list just for toilets and then the rest of the renovation as well. But we'll get back to more of your calls on this in just a moment. If you want to join, 1300 222 774. But genetic testing, we know it can play a critical role in the prevention of disease, in particular when it comes to things like heart disease and cancer. But it's expensive and it's not widely accessible. But researchers at Monash are calling for government funding to try and develop a national preventative genomic testing program. And the team there have just recently led a pilot study that actually does offer free genomic testing to around 10,000 Australians aged between 18 and 40. Dr. Jane Tyler is an ethical, legal and social advisor in public health genomics at Monash and has been behind this. Jane, you've been calling for this and you want this expansion. This is something you've been calling for a long time, but what in particular would you like?
Thanks so much for having me. And it's really critical time for this because we're actually now putting in a submission to Treasury and to the Health Budget around a budget submission for funding. And we have done this pilot study that you mentioned. We tested 10,000 young people for genetic high risk of things like cancer and heart disease that they can prevent. We found one in 50 people, so that's 2% of the people that we tested, had one of these high risk genetic variants, and we were able to offer them preventive care. But we want to offer this to a broader slice of the Australian population. We would love to move towards a preventive program using genetics to prevent disease. And so what we're asking for is funding to scale up that program from the 10,000 that we did in the last iteration to a 100,000 person study in the future. And that's what we're asking the government to fund in the next step.
So in this, the 10,000 Australians that were a part of this particular study, what bubbled to the surface? What were some of the main things that were discovered that were achieved from this?
So we, as I said, we tested about 10,000 people. We had huge interest. We had tens of thousands of people register their interest, and we know people want this testing. And we just looked for three conditions. So breast and ovarian and prostate cancer is one group of genes. Bowel cancer is one group. And then genetic high cholesterol leading to heart attacks is the third one. And across those three, we found just over 200 people who were at high risk. And so that's about one in 50. 2% of people had a genetic change that makes them very susceptible, and we were able to give them preventive care. But some of the things that were really critical were 3/4 of those people, if they'd gone to the doctor and said, I want a genetic test, would have been told, you're not eligible for that. There's no criteria that you satisfy. We can't fund a publicly funded genetic test for you. And more than half of them didn't have any family history in first degree relatives. So our criteria is very based on assuming that family history is what makes you high risk, and people think, oh, I don't have a family history of cancer, so I'm not at risk. That's not the case. And also assuming that if we wait until people have these cancers have heart attacks, and then we test that we're going to find people, and we're just not finding 90% of the high-risk people out there using that criteria that we currently use.
Do you think the average person even knows to ask for genetic testing and whether or not they even think that that is something that is possible for them?
I think they don't. You know, I think the average person is becoming more aware of genetics and what it means. People are becoming more aware that there might be something in our DNA that tells us about disease. Most people don't know about this testing because it's not broadly available, because they're told, if you're at risk, you know, your doctor will tell you. And if you've got a family history, you'll be told that this is something you should do. The fact is, we're missing people doing the testing that way, and most people don't know that they might be at risk. However, that is changing. And like I said, when we advertised our study in the pilot phase a few years ago, within one day we had 10,000 people sign up, and that was all the spots we had. And within the next weeks we had tens of thousands more people. We still have people adding themselves to our wait list in the hopes that we get funding and we can offer testing to them. So people are becoming more aware of it, but it's not offered.
So it's not offered
to most people.
If the government listened and if they offered more funding for something like this, how would everybody benefit? Is this about prevention?
Yeah, they benefit in two ways. One is that thousands and thousands of people who don't know they're high risk would find out that they are high risk, and they would get testing, they would get surveillance, preventive measures would be offered, their family members would get testing. And so for those thousands of people, it would directly save lives. It would prevent cancers, it would prevent deaths from cancer and heart disease. But more broadly, this is very good economically. It's good health economics. And so if we save money in treating very, very expensive cancers, then it's good for the hospital system and the healthcare system generally, investing in prevention. We all know that that's a good thing to do. And this is direct prevention. It's not just, you know, the idea of prevention generally. It's finding the people. And also people who are at high genetic risk are at risk when they're younger. And so it's not just a high risk of cancer. It's a high risk in your 30s and 40s. And these are people like in the health system, people who are working and productive, and when they get sick, they come out of the workforce. They have to quit their jobs often. Sometimes a parent quits to look after them. So the productivity impacts for the economy are also very
significant. Yeah, it snowballs. Just finally, Jane, if this was to happen, if you got the extra funding to make the genetic testing wider and more accessible for people, how would it then impact health insurance? So there's a really clever question here from Varel who says, genetic testing for disease, what impact would this have on health insurance and disease risk? So if more of us are getting genetic testing, if more of us are finding out that maybe, yes, you know, you do need to do X, Y, and Z as a result of your family genes, what will that do to health insurance?
So health insurance is community rated in Australia. So everyone gets health insurance no matter what their risks are and no matter what kind of testing they've had, which is good. It might have some impact eventually on prevention, and that will make costs of treatment lower. The thing that people are really concerned about is life insurance impacts, because life insurers, as we've discussed before, Rochelle, have been legally allowed for a long time to use people's genetic tests to discriminate. And people have been worried about that. It's the biggest reason people pull out of studies and clinical testing, is because they're worried about life insurance discrimination. Now, I'm really pleased to report that after all the work that we've done over many years, the government has introduced legislation, and that was introduced in November. We expect that to be debated in Parliament and passed hopefully in the next month. Obviously, it depends what happens in Parliament, but there's a lot of support for it. And so that law will come into effect later this year, and that will really protect people's genetic information in that way. And it's been really great to see how engaged the community has been, how many people have written to their MPs and written to government to say that they needed to do this action on genetic discrimination. They've listened and they've done it. And that really paves the way now for greater investment into genomics. And people can do the same thing. If there are listeners who are interested, who want this kind of testing, who think it should be funded, they can write to their MPs and they can say, can you do this? Can you fund this? we've set up a form that people can, if they go to the DNA Screen website, they can find that and they can find their MP and send something off. So there's certainly action and availability for that kind of
to get informed. Yeah. Well, your work and your advocacy in this area is tireless, Jane. So thank you. Keep us up to date with what happens. Dr. Jane Tyler, Ethical, Legal and Social Advisor in Public Health of Genomics at Monash University. 5 minutes away from midday, well, you would have heard the news today that Australian Open director Craig Tiley will step down from Tennis Australia. He's taking up a role as chief executive of United States Tennis Association. Peter Mercato is a tennis commentator with the AO and currently researching Tennis Australia. Peter, everybody sort of knew about it. It was Australia, if not the world's worst kept secret. So the news dropped today. What will his legacy be, do you think?
Hi, Rochelle. Yeah, it's going to be a big one because the transformation, and I've been working at the Australian Open and with Tennis Australia for pretty much the entire time that Craig's actually been, well, started off as the tournament director and then was tournament director and CEO. And I mean, the best way to describe it is if you sort of think 20 years ago, the way that we were sort of looking at the Australian Open was as a tennis tournament. You know, big tennis tournament, one of the big four tournaments, and that was great and people came and everything like that. Now it is an event. It's something that people go along to. They may not necessarily be tennis fans, but it is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger. Part of that is a legacy of, you know, being the sort of we're miles away from the other majors and everything like that, and we need to make sure that the, you know, we're the best, and certainly they've done that. But also it's just been the vision and the creativity and the idea of getting people in through the gates, but in and playing tennis as well.
Do you think that he will try and replicate what was created here in the United States, or is it too different? Is the appetite too different?
Well, it's a different tournament. It's a different flavour. It's a different feel, the US Open compared to the Australian Open. I mean, one of the key things that he's going to be focused on, which he was here too, is participation. So making sure that American kids have got rackets in their hands and that they're out there and they're playing tennis, because that obviously leads to the health of the sport, and then obviously the Grand Slam tournament over the top of that as well. So, you know, he's come from that background. He's come from that tennis background as opposed to an administration background, and that'll be the one of the big focuses that he's got. But also it's not turning the US Open into the Australian Open. It's keeping the flavor of the US Open and seeing, you know, what can be done over there. How can he build it? How can he work with the team to create a tournament that has a sense of uniqueness and the Americanness that we know that tournament to be?
Well, it's going to be interesting. I know there's a worldwide search looking for the next director, so it will be interesting to see. Any hints, Peter? Any clues?
it's not me, if that's going to help.
It's not me either.
Well, there's two
Thank
that
God.
We could rule off the list. But, yeah, look, I've got the feeling, as we've seen with these sporty organisations that we have, that, you know, the search is worldwide, and it will be a worldwide search that will happen, but generally they sort of find someone next in the office next door.
Yeah, so that's right.
Look, the VNTA is the work as a team. Yes, Craig Tiley's been big and he's been the main focus, but there are a number of great people within the walls of Tennis Australia that can continue the legacy on, but it's going to be a big loss for tennis here in Australia, because he's done a hell of a lot of great work. Whether you know, criticise or whatever, he has done a fantastic job.
Good to get your thoughts on this, Peter. Thank you. Peter Mercato, tennis commentator at the Australian Open. And it's so true, there's a worldwide search, and at the end they say, actually, you know what, just give it to Jenny in Cubicle 2. She's worked really hard and been here for a long time. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.